contrast to this repetition of the pronouns they and them that you find in verse 3. So you have then, especially keeping in mind what by this time we've already covered in 1 Thessalonians, all the way back to 1 Thessalonians 1:10, you have those who wait for His Son from heaven are not concerned with times and seasons. Isn't it interesting how many people get so concerned about when the Lord will come? The righteous, what we see in 1 Thessalonians, our minds are to be at rest about it. We can't know it anyway when He is going to return because we're always ready. And perhaps we haven't had that focus, but people who, oh, they think they're very spiritual and, hey, you know, the Lord is, He's coming soon, you better get ready. And then they try to start identifying, hey, it's going to be on such and such a date, and just a fixation upon when the Lord returns. Well, if you're always ready, by staying ready, then we're not concerned about the times and seasons. But isn't that interesting? That back to Acts chapter 1 that we already looked at, in verse 7, Jesus said it's not for you to know the times or seasons. And so, it's not for us to know. Why are we so fixated, but yet people are? So fixated upon something that is unknowable to us. And we're not supposed to put a lot of interest into that because it's an exercise in futility just to be ready, to always be ready. And yet that's what happened in the first century. You have at least the apostles asking Jesus that. You have the Thessalonians so very concerned with it that there is, you know, a lot of people think that 1 Thessalonians, that, hey, that's the primary dominating thing, when actually Paul is trying to do some corrective teaching just based upon what they already knew or should have known, and to be able to continue making this wonderful progress that you read of in 1 Thessalonians 1 about their evangelism. Sometimes we see it so much that, you know, hey, they really were off base about, you know, wondering about whether or not there was going to be any hope, and all about the Lord's coming. We sometimes overlook what we have in the first chapter, that they were such marvelous examples of evangelism. Paul says, we do not need to say anything. Who else does he say that to? That, hey, you know, you've done such a fine job of teaching and preaching the gospel, we don't need to say anything more about encouraging you along those lines. But notice also, we had talked about when we were in, some time ago, we were in 1 Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 3. Notice this connection with patience of hope in chapter 1, verse 3, with waiting for His Son from heaven. Now, you can render it as patience of hope, but it is the technical word for endurance or perseverance. And some of your translations may have it as endurance of hope or perseverance of hope. But it is also that concept of a, you could render it as a patient endurance, a patiently enduring. And especially with what you have in chapter 1, verse 10, you know, just a few verses later after verse 3, it is that connection, especially when we notice that your work in chapter 1, verse 3, your work of faith, labor of love, patience of hope, work of faith. And then you'll see in verses 8 through 10, the work of faith, you turn from idols to serve the living and true God. So you turned your work of faith and then your labor of love to serve the living and true God, and then your patience of hope to wait for His Son from heaven, even Jesus, who delivers us from the coming wrath or the wrath to come, various translations. So, this waiting for His Son, we're not bogged down in, you know, the worry and concern about when Christ comes. And we're certainly not these evil individuals who are, the picture we're going to see, and it's going to develop as we continue, they are completely, so uncompletely prepared. They're not prepared at all. They're quite the opposite. They are spiritually asleep. They are spiritual drunkards. And perhaps we may see that, you know, you put those two concepts together, it's possible that you would get then a picture of a sleeping drunkard. But it does seem like you could also argue perhaps even better that it is, you have those who sleep at night, those who get drunk at night. And so they're seen as the ones who are not watchful at all. They've fallen asleep on the watch, and then they're completely unreliable. They're drinking at night. And so notice, based on what we have in verses 3 through 5, here in verse 3, Christ will come at a time when the ungodly feel safe and secure to continue doing as they please. That might remind us more of what we even see in 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3, you know, where's the promise of His coming? You know, there's just no alarm. Safe and secure from all alarm, if you will. And so, if you're righteous, sure, that's right. But if you're wicked and ungodly, it's not going to be that you're safe. It's not going to be that things are going to just continue and things are going to go well for you. It's going to be sudden destruction. And the suddenness of their destruction is likened to the suddenness of a woman who goes into labor. Isn't it interesting that a pregnant woman, you might not be able to identify exactly when, but you know it's going to absolutely happen. And so that's the thing. The Lord's coming is an absolute certainty, just as surely as a pregnant woman who's going to go into labor, but we don't know when that's going to happen. So absolutely sure, it's impending. But we don't know when. The suddenness of their destruction is now seen as not just as a thief coming at night unexpectedly and don't know, it's going to come absolutely surely. It's surely going to happen. So, other terminology, their destruction is inevitable, just as the inevitable labor pains on a pregnant woman. Notice then verses 4 and 5. But you, brothers, and this is going to be plural again, all of you, you, brothers, are not in darkness. So we start with verse 1, but concerning the times and seasons, brothers, and now once again, you, brothers, are not in darkness. So you have the ungodly, the unrighteous, are seen in darkness. And notice that's one of the recurring themes. And how even in the Old Testament, your word is a lamp to my feet, a light to my path. It's dispelling the darkness. Jesus said, you are the light of the world, Matthew 5, verse 16. And Jesus said, he himself is the light of the world, John chapter 8, verse 12, and John chapter 9, verse 4. So you have, but you, brothers, are not in darkness, so that this day should overtake you as a thief. You are all sons of light and sons of the day. We are not of the night nor of darkness. So Paul now focuses on this unwelcome aspect of the Lord's return, but it's not unwelcome for the righteous. It's unwelcome for the ungodly, for the wicked, the unprepared, because that's the picture we have that is developing. These people are unattentive. They're not watchful. They are not focused on anything but themselves. Part of Jesus' coming includes the inescapable catastrophe that will certainly and surely come upon the ungodly. Paul uses the verb that is translated as overtake. It's katalambano. So overtake, which means to seize with hostile, or some would say hostile, intent. To emphasize the menacing part of the Lord's return. And that's really, I think, a great way to word that, to seize with hostile intent. Menacing part of the Lord's return. That it should overtake you. You know, this is not for you. It's not intended that you should be swallowed up in this destruction. Much, I think, as we've been studying on Wednesday nights, you can see in Matthew chapter 25, that hell is going to be prepared not for us, not for God's human creation, but for the devil and his angels. But if you're not righteous, you don't do the will of God, you will be caught up in that destruction, just as we've been studying in Revelation. Believers are cautioned and warned that if they're not faithful, then they too are going to meet the same fate and the same destruction as the persecutors of the church. But the faithful are going to receive the crown of life. They won't have Christ come upon them as a thief, to go back to what we mentioned previously in Revelation 3, verse 3. So Paul uses this word overtake here to emphasize that, hey, they don't realize it. They are going to be completely overwhelmed, overtaken, seized with hostile intent. These ungodly, these wicked. So Paul says that the Thessalonian Christians, they're not in darkness. We know that that's in contrast to the light that's mentioned in verse 5. So Christians are not in and of the night. And notice that terminology that we have here in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, because we have both in the night, the thief that comes in the night, but then we also have the terminology that we are not in darkness, verse 4, and we are not of the night, verse 5. So you have both in darkness, verse 4, and not of the night, nor of darkness, in verse 5. So Christ's coming will not bring destruction upon the righteous, as His coming will bring destruction upon the wicked. Christians are therefore to be prepared. Be prepared lest they are, to use the word again, overtaken, as the unprepared are overtaken in a battle. Just imagine you're all asleep, or you had a good number of them that are, you know, some are asleep, some are actually drinking, and some are in a stupefied, drunken sleep. And then the Spartans come in. How well are we all going to fare if we're all asleep and people are drinking? I mean, you're all dead. You know, it's seized with hostile intent. Whatever picture came to the Thessalonian mind with this word, it was that picture of it can't be any worse. And yet that's how unprepared those that are outside of the church are. And this is also motivation for you stay alert, you stay awake, you stay watchful, just as we see these same kind of things, the encouragement toward faithfulness, and here's the reward, and here's the punishment, and here's the destruction that awaits the wicked. Verse 6, therefore, we should not sleep. And some of our translations say, therefore, let us not sleep. It does seem like it's better based upon this word. You would use the we versus the let us. Therefore, let us not sleep. And also you have, if you're reading in English and you're reading, therefore, let us not sleep, we're probably going to be thinking that that's more of an imperative. And while this, technically, it's a subjunctive, the subjunctive is, I do believe, functioning more of what we would say a command or an imperative. It is technically a subjunctive. So that if you're, you know, doing the translation on this, I think maybe the Numeric Standard, whatever translations you're using that have it, instead of therefore let us not sleep, therefore we should not sleep is going to be more technically correct in translation. And notice then, as others do, I think the New King James has as the others, or as others do. This is the phraseology that we'll have, and we become familiar with also in 1 Corinthians. As, you know, to the rest, and of course there you have to determine, well, is Paul talking about to the rest of the groups or the rest of the questions? And so you have that there in 1 Corinthians. Here it's clearly the rest or the others. These are the ungodly, the wicked, who are spiritually asleep. And he says we should watch and we should be sober. And so, yes, sleep is figurative for this spiritual sleep. He's not talking about literally taking a nap or going to sleep literally here. Now, in 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 13 through 15, Paul used sleep figuratively for death. So we have to become familiar with how it's being used. It's clear in 1 Thessalonians 4, 13 through 15, when he talks about those who sleep in Jesus, we're talking about those who have died in Christ. So sleep figuratively, chapter 4, 13 through 15. Here, we're talking about in chapter 5, verse 6, figurative. But we're also going to see another use of sleep as well in a bit. Notice here in this context, we should be sober. Sober conveys the idea of living life in control and having a very clear perception of what is happening and of what one is doing. So there's no alcohol, if you will, spiritual alcohol that is dulling your senses. This is this concept of, and we'll talk a little bit more about this, it is complete abstinence from wine. Nothing that would possibly blur your vision or fog your mind. This is what Dr. Strong said years ago. He said that this word, napho, translated as sober, means to abstain from wine. And here in verse 6, it is used figuratively to convey soberness and watchfulness. Notice, if you pull up, this is Bible Gateway, Bible Hub. This one is Bible Hub on the word sober. And it gives you Strong's number 3525, napho. And you will see that they give a short definition. I'm calm, vigilant, sober. Literally, I'm sober, I'm calm, vigilant. And notice you have not drunk, not intoxicated, figuratively free from illusion, and free from the intoxicating influence of sin. And so that's how we're seeing that it is that we're not in darkness, we're not of darkness, we're not consumed in the world, we're not walking in the steps of the world. So you have then, it's this concept of unintoxicated. And it refers to having presence of mind, clear judgment, enabling someone to be temperate, self-controlled, and uninfluenced by intoxicants. To have all of your faculties, your wits about you. And as we just delve into this aspect of it, how could we possibly come to Scripture and try to defend social drinking where, just as long as you drink in moderation, and yeah, you know, your senses may be dulled a little bit, but as long as it's just not too much. The picture we have of what Paul wants us to be prepared for is absolute all-out spiritual warfare and battle, because we're seen as guardians. We're seen as the ones who stay awake. There's no distraction. There's no interference. And so it does become very clear that any advocates of social drinking and just as long as you drink alcohol in moderation, it's preposterous when we come to a study of a passage like 1 Thessalonians 5 that if God would say, oh, well, you know, you can't do it spiritually, but you can do it physically. Well, you cannot become intoxicated physically and maintain spiritual soberness. It's utterly impossible. You don't have your wits about you. You're falling under all the condemnations that we see and read of in the Old Testament. And they say, oh, well, but in moderation. Where do you see moderation in a discussion spiritually? It's like, okay, well, you can drink physically, you can drink, but it has no spiritual implications as long as you do it in moderation. And you can get nearly drunk, but not quite there, and you're still very much sober, spiritually speaking, very much alert. But yet, that's what we have, even within the church, of people arguing for the social drinking aspect. We're going to stop here. Lord willing, we'll pick back up and we'll have a little bit more on this discussion before we will go back in, Lord willing, next Sunday into our discussion of Revelation. If you're here today, if we can help in any of your spiritual needs, would you come as we stand, as we sing?
326.